Okay, Mr. Grace, I'm going to do a short preamble, and we'll get underway.
Fine.
This is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is November 2nd, 2010. The time is approximately 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I am accompanied by various members of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and David Grace. We are at the offices of the FCIC for the interview of Mr. Grace. This is a telephonic interview. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Grace. Mr. Grace, could I get your verbal assent for the record?
Yes, I assent.
Thank you, sir. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name. I'll start with Cunicelli, C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I. And Mr. Grace, I'll bring you in last, sir.
Tom Borgers, B as in boy, O-R-G-E-R-S.
John Armstrong, A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G.
Tom Krebs, F-C-I-C, that's K-R-E-B-S.
And Bob Hinckley, H-I-N-K-L-E-Y, with the FCIC staff.
All right, Mr. Grace, that's us, if you would be so kind.
Sure, David J. Grace, G-R-A-I-S, Grace and Ellsworth, New York.
Excellent. Mr. Grace, in the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the President, Public Law 111-21. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire.
No, thank you.
Okay. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code Section 1001 concerning false statements. A couple of housekeeping things. Just please make sure that your responses are audible and verbal, so that we obtain a quality transcript if we end up transcripting this tape. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Krebs and Hinckley.
David, Tom Krebs, we have been following quite closely an emerging issue, wherein it is alleged that as a result of MERS and other intermediaries, that the assignments to the RMBS were never made, and thus the mortgages, the RMBS don't own the mortgages. Have you come across that, and what's your take on it?
I have come across it. I have studied it only very slightly, and my sense, and it's not well informed, is that it's not going to amount to a big issue, but I don't pretend to have gotten to the bottom of it.
Well, just by way of example, we have interviewed folks who had a foreclosure instituted by MERS, and they allegedly came in as a nominee, and the court says, whoa, you can't be a nominee. You don't have a stake in the outcome of this deal. And sure enough, the next day they come in with an assignment to a New York trust dated that day or the day before, which is more than 2 years after the date of the closure of the trust under New York law on the closing date and under the REMIC statutes. Have you run across that at all?
Only in my following of the news reports. It's not a subject that I've studied in any depth at all.
David, let's go to the complaint that you filed on behalf of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Chicago.
We did not file Chicago. We would have liked to, but we lost that engagement to another firm here in Seattle, actually.
Oh, okay.
They're also a very good firm, Keller Rohrbach, and the lawyer there is Amy Williams Derry, who's very good. And Chicago chose them over us. We filed on behalf of the FHLBs of Seattle and San Francisco.
David, can you summarize very quickly the nature of your allegations against them? I mean, I don't care what the legal allegations were, but whether or not they were in the nature of failure to do due diligence, failure to disclose, what they were.
The gist of our allegations in both Seattle and San Francisco is simply that there were material inaccuracies in the disclosure documents by which the investment banks sold securities backed by Alt-A mortgages. I don't think there are any subprime mortgages. In our case for Charles Schwab, which is a private sector financial company, as you know, we have a couple of bonds in that case that are backed by prime mortgages, but almost all of our bonds are backed by Alt-A mortgages. And the theory of our of all of our cases is simply that there were material inaccuracies in the prospectus supplements by which the investment banks sold the bonds to our clients. If you'd like, I can go into what the inaccuracies were, but under the state blue sky laws, which are the statutes that we're proceeding under.
That's interesting. Go ahead.
The state blue sky laws are...
All right, but I represent, in real life, the Alabama retirement systems and a number, so I'm familiar with them. I was the former securities commissioner in Alabama, so I have an understanding of how good they are.
They're really great, as you know, and they put on the side a lot of issues that would otherwise complicate a case under the federal laws. And so, in our opinion, all we have to prove is that there were material inaccuracies in the prospectus supplements, and we are then entitled to rescind, and we hand back the bonds and the distributions of principal and interest that we've received on the bonds, and they hand us back the purchase price plus interest. So all the issues about loss causation, yeah, and damages and so on are put to the side, as are all issues about the state of mind of the seller, scienter,
yes,
negligence, all that stuff we consider to be out of our cases. Cases are quite narrow.
How do you avoid the NISMIA and SLUSA and those requirements that such actions be filed in federal court? Is there a carve-out for these entities that you've represented?
Well, a partner of mine's our expert on NISMIA, but I believe that the preemption of NISMIA does not extend to this type of action, because we've looked into it and we've received the defendant's motions to dismiss our complaint in Seattle, and they don't mention it, so I'm sure if there were an argument under NISMIA, they would have made it. And with respect to SLUSA, we have been at great pains to file our cases in state court. They have removed them to federal court. The judge in Seattle remanded them to state court. And one of the biggest reasons we prefer state court is because then we have no risk of being consolidated with a class action and therefore getting swept up under SLUSA.
Well, I'm absolutely understanding, and that's precisely the theory that we apply when we file under that SLUSA carve-out for pension funds. But how is it you're managing to get the cases remanded?
Well, the theories of federal jurisdiction are primarily that the language of the congressional charter of the FHLBs makes every case involving an FHLB one that arises under federal law, and therefore there's federal jurisdiction. And two judges in the D.C. Circuit agreed with that. Not in one of our cases, but we persuaded Judge Martinez in Seattle that they were wrong, and there was a very strong dissent. And so he held that the language of the bank's federal charter does not confer federal jurisdiction. The other primary basis of jurisdiction is related to bankruptcy jurisdiction, because some of the investment banks argue that if they lose their cases to us, they're entitled to indemnity from the originators of the mortgages, and some of those originators are bankrupt.
Yeah, I've been there, seen that one too.
And Judge Martinez agreed with that, but exercised his equitable power to remand the cases anyway, because the number of loans involved was so tiny.
How many loans were involved in your case?
Seattle case, I think about 125,000, but the number that were originated by bankrupt originators was really tiny, a couple thousand, and so that was one of the reasons why he remanded it.
Tell us about the causes of actions. What are they based upon? What are the misrepresentations and omissions that you feel are the strongest in your claim?
In the amended, well, let me just give you a minute of background by way of explanation. We built up our original complaints based on information about the industry in general, detailed but still general. In September of 2009, a federal judge in Boston, Judge Stearns, decided the case of Plumbers Union against Nomura and dismissed a complaint on similar securities because it didn't have any information about the particular loans in the collateral pool of those transactions. Mm-hmm. So in an effort led by a guy named John McMurray, who's one of the unsung heroes of the credit crisis because he was the main whistleblower Countrywide and was actually the main witness for the SEC in its case against Mozilla. John McMurray was chief risk officer of the Seattle Bank until recently, and he's a super big brain, and he actually led an effort with a company called CoreLogic, which is the leading supplier of data about real estate transactions, to figure out how to use the CoreLogic databases to get loan-level information about the specific loans in the collateral pools of the trust we were suing on. So we amended our complaints in June using data that John and CoreLogic and we had learned how to extract, and we basically have the following theories that the data support. The first is that the loan-to-value ratio of the loan, which is probably the single most important metric of a loan, was understated because the appraisals that of the mortgage properties that go into the denominator of the loan-to-value ratio were inflated. And CoreLogic has an automated valuation model, which it learned how to run over each property on the date on which the mortgage loan closed. And we then compared that to the value that was used in the denominator of the LTV, and we found a couple things. One is that in quite a few cases, the value used in the LTV was quite a bit higher than the value gotten from the automated valuation model. But what was especially interesting was two things. One is that in many cases, the discrepancy was really pretty huge. There were cases where the reported value was 150%, 180%, 200% of the actual value. And most interestingly, if you compare the number of loans where the appraisal was way too high with the number where it was too low, there's a tremendous skew, somewhere between 3 times and 8 times, depending on the trust, 3 times to 8 times more properties were seriously overappraised than seriously underappraised, which tends to bear out the evidence we've been hearing, what everybody's been hearing, that there was a lot of pressure on appraisers to appraise at a high value.
I'm glad you fixed on the appraisal issue, because we're kind of trying to focus on that a little bit here. In our writing, we have a number of folks who testified before the commission, but where did you find your principal resources or information with respect to the activities that were ongoing in the appraisal business then?
Probably the single main one was a petition that 11,000 professional appraisers signed that was addressed to an agency of the government, and to be honest, I'm not remembering the name, but there is, in the Treasury Department, there's a fairly obscure agency whose purpose is to make sure that appraisals are done correctly when there's a federal interest in the transaction. And since Fannie and Freddie were buying so many residential mortgages, this agency was charged to look after the appraisal process, and 11,000 professional appraisers addressed a petition to it starting early, like 2003 through 2009, in which they detailed allegations of the pressure against them. The other is that there's a research company called October Research that did 2 surveys of appraisers and again found widespread, many respondents reported that they had been subject to widespread pressure. So those were the 2 sources that covered a wide sample of appraisers. We probably had anecdotal evidence of individual instances, but those were the 2 main sources, which I'd be happy to send you if you'd like.
We would love to see both of those, and if that could be done quickly, we would very much appreciate it, because we're actually, Bob Hinckley and I are looking at writing amending a portion of our report on the appraisal problems, and it is very timely that you reference these, this petition and the October research materials, and we thank you for that. It's really helpful.
Sure. Let me just...
Here, I'm going to give you my email address.
Right. I was just reaching for my pen. Let's do that now before we forget.
Yes.
Okay.
That would be...
Okay. Well, I have a colleague back in New York who can send those to you as soon as we get off the phone.
Oh, that would be perfect. So you've got your information there on the appraisals in connection with the LTVs.
I will also send you. Let me just again digress for a second. We have three of these cases going, as I mentioned, the two FHLBs and then Charles Schwab. Between them, we've studied, I want to say, about 650 to 700,000 loans across 200 and some trusts involving, at least 30 or 40 different originators and about 15 investment banks. And we could compile for you all this information is in all the complaints, and I'll ask my colleague to send you a sample complaint. But we could also put together for you, just in tabular form, the information that we have across all 650,000 loans.
Wow.
Terrific.
That would
great.
Be, who conducted the research or the review for you? Did you do it internally, or did you employ someone to assist you in the endeavor?
Well, we purchased the data from this company called CoreLogic, which is the leading vendor of realty data, and then we analyzed it internally. But there's not that much analysis to do, and it's they provide us the data, and we have worked with them on their protocols to make sure that we're satisfied with the integrity of the data. I'll comment on that in a minute when we get to some of the other aspects. But we get a data file off of an FTP site, and it takes us a day or so to analyze it, and we have a financial analyst who does it, but it's not that big a deal.
Huh.
So anyway, LTVs was one. The second one was undisclosed additional liens on the property. And you may have seen a paper written by two economists at the New York Fed in 2008 by Adam Ashcraft and Till Schurman. And they wrote in their paper that about 25% of securitized first mortgages in 2005 to 2007 had silent seconds. That is, seconds that were not disclosed to the originator or, as we learned, to the purchasers of bonds based on those mortgages. And their data came from a confidential source that the Fed had access to and we didn't. But when we look at the CoreLogic data, we look at each first lien loan in these pools, and they check the public land records on the date of the securitization. And sure enough, something in the neighborhood of 20% did indeed have second or additional liens on the property of public record already filed on the date of the securitization that were not disclosed in the prospectus supplement for the securitization. So that's the second kind of bucket of things that we are focused on, the additional liens. The third, and in some respects most intriguing, is occupancy. All of these disclosures state the number of properties that are the principal residence of the borrowers versus those that are second homes or investment properties.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously primary residences make the mortgage much more creditworthy.
Sure.
For each of the mortgages, we looked at a bunch of data. For the two banks, we looked at, for example, how many properties does the borrower own? And if the borrower owns three or more, we took that as evidence that he didn't live in the one that was the subject of the securitization. In addition, we looked at where did the borrower tell the tax authorities to send the property tax bill for the house. And if the borrower said to send it to a residential address other than the mortgage property, we take that as evidence that the person really didn't live there.
Yeah, good.
Similarly with homesteads, it's possible in many jurisdictions to designate your principal residence as a homestead, which gives you some protection against creditors and some tax relief. And in those jurisdictions, we looked at whether the borrower did designate the property as a homestead, and if not, but he could have, we consider that to be evidence that he didn't live in the property. Now, by the time we did the Schwab complaint, which came about a month later, we had another way of studying this, which we hadn't done for the two banks, but we may do later. We got a credit report on the borrower 6 months after the closing of the loan. And if the borrower, if the address of the mortgage property was not an address at the which the borrower was getting any bills, according to any of the three credit rating agencies, 6 months after, then we figure the person couldn't live there, because when you buy a house, normally 6 months is enough time to paint and paper and fix the roof and move in and change and send change of address notices. So if you're not getting a single bill, including the mortgage bill, at that address 6 months after you close, probably you're not living there. That we were able to do only for Schwab, because the availability of those credit reports didn't come in time to do it for the San Francisco banks and Seattle Bank.
David, what are the dates of the complaints, more or less, to the month?
The first complaint for Seattle was December 23rd of 2009,
yep.
And then the first complaint for the San Francisco Bank was in March. The key thing, though, is these amended complaints, which include the CoreLogic data, because the data from the original complaints didn't include any of this data, and those were June 10th of 2010.
And Charles Schwab?
July 2010.
Okay. Thank you.
And then the last one, which, you know, I would ask you, I'm being candid with you in saying that I think that there are some weaknesses in it.
If you're about to tell us something that you don't want to go on the record, David, I'm going to admonish you not to. We will go off the record, and you can have that discussion with us. But to the extent that you're about to tell us anything that might impact or adversely affect a case that you're bringing, I would recommend you not do it at this juncture. We will give you the opportunity at the conclusion of this event.
Okay. Well, then thank you very much. Then let me just say, while we're on the record, that the last of our theories is that the originators of the loans made undisclosed departures from the underwriting standards that were stated in the prospectus supplements. And this is a theory that the courts have endorsed. Judge Kaplan in the Southern District of New York was the first judge who accepted that theory, and several other judges have since. And we use various types of delinquency information, as Judge Kaplan and others have approved, in order to bolster the allegations that the originator departed from the underwriting standards. In addition, various federal and state investigations have been made of a couple of originators, so we have extremely detailed information about Countrywide, based primarily on the Attorney General's investigation and settlement with them in 2008, and even more so on the SEC's insider trading case against Mozilla and Samble, which just settled. But before it settled, the court papers there gave us a lot of detail about what was going on in Countrywide. And then the FDIC did an investigation of IndyMac. So we from those sources, we have kind of an inside picture of what was going on at those originators. For the others, we have to rely on delinquency metrics about their loans.
Have you seen the Massachusetts AG's workover of people, who was it?
Morgan Stanley.
Well, not Morgan Stanley, but New Century.
I have not. I've read the Mike Missel, who was the bankruptcy examiner of New Century, and I've read his report, which is a couple years old now. New Century collateral is not in any of our cases because they were a subprime originator, and the banks didn't buy any subprime-backed loans.
Gotcha.
In subprime-backed bonds.
Sure.
I know that Attorney General Coakley reached a good settlement with Goldman, but I was interested in that primarily from the standpoint of whether Goldman had securitized those loans that it agreed to modify in satisfaction of its settlement with her, and in fact, it had not securitized them. It owned those loans, so we represent a lot of bond investors, and obviously. That's why we're having this call. And we're always very concerned when someone makes a settlement with the governmental authority and then tries to pass back to the securitization investors the cost of the penalties. So that's what Countrywide did in 08, and I researched the Massachusetts settlement to see whether Goldman was doing that, but it was not.
Uh-huh. And the Charles Schwab, is that also Alt-A and not subprime?
There's no subprime. It's mainly Alt-A, but one of the interesting things is that they asked us to look at the prime securities, and I said, oh, we don't know anything about prime securities. We'd better not do that. But then we looked at their delinquency metrics, and some of them performed just like prime, like 2%, really good experience. Others of them were performing as bad as some of the worst Alt-A deals, and so what was happening was that I think in 2006 and 2007 especially, that a lot of prime deals were, a lot of Alt-A deals were being mislabeled as prime deals. And
and so subprime as well, probably.
And subprime being mislabeled as Alt-A. But
yeah.
On the trusts that were performing poorly, we actually went and bought the CoreLogic data to test the theory that the disclosure problems may have infected the prime pools. And sure enough, on the prime pools that were performing as badly as Alt-A pools, the data was just as bad as Alt-A pools. So we actually included those prime pools in our case for Schwab.
And in your case for Schwab, is that Schwab as an investor or Schwab as an investment advisor for...
It's Schwab as an investor for its own account. Schwab owns a bank called Charles Schwab Bank, and Charles Schwab Bank invested in these for its own account. This is not any of Schwab's activities for customers. This was just its own investment account.
All right. All right. And how big a case are these two things? I came to this conversation thinking you'd have the Chicago case. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Well, we measure these cases by the amount that our clients paid for the bonds, because that's the amount that plus interest that the defendants would have to return if we won. And, of course, we'd be returning the bonds, which have some value, so it's not really a complete measure of the value of the case. But in round numbers, the Seattle Bank spent $4 billion, the San Francisco Bank $19 billion, and Schwab $2 billion. So I guess if you add all that up, it's about $25 billion of transactions that we're trying to rescind.
Okay.
The data that hopefully we're going to get is going to be very helpful to us, I think. Don't you, Bob?
Oh, yeah. Could you send along a copy of the complaint? I think you said you would.
Yes, I'm going to email a colleague, Leanne Wilson, who will send you whatever you like, but I'll mention to her the thing that we've spoken about in the call.
Super. What do you think the outcome of this is going to be? Are these banks going to be able to stand up to these claims? I mean, there are going to be others coming, as you know. Well, you've probably seen an increase in the number of filings that have been made against them.
Well, I gave I know you guys are pressed for time, but and in New York we refer to this as, you know, train time, but you guys probably don't take the train. But we had a conference last week on robo-signers, but more generally on mortgage-related litigation, which is accessible from our website. And even if you don't have time to watch the webcast, I would respectfully draw your attention to the cartoon, which is on our webpage, because it sort of expresses my view of this whole situation. But it seems to me that there are basically three channels of litigation going on. One is cases like these, which are securities law cases against the dealers that sold the bonds. And it's possible that there will be more cases. We're talking to investors about more cases, but the statutes of limitations are coming to an end fairly soon. The only one that's got a lot of time left in it is Massachusetts, because it's a four-year statute. So I think that there will probably be some more cases. We hope we'll be bringing a few more cases, but I'm not expecting a landslide of these cases just because the time is running short. The second, and I think that the cases are in amounts that the banks could certainly afford the liabilities. Our biggest defendant is Deutsche Bank, from which the San Francisco Bank bought $4 billion of bonds. But they're super senior extra credit enhanced bonds that are probably trading, I'm guessing, between 60 and 70 cents on the dollar. So call that a net liability to Deutsche Bank of $1 billion. Well, Deutsche Bank could certainly bear that without risk. So I think that our cases are not going to jeopardize the health of the banks. But the second stream of cases is a little different, which is cases to require the originators of loans that sold them into securitization trusts to repurchase the loans that didn't comply with the reps and warranties that were made about them. And there, the potential liability, in my opinion, is really huge, because the same core logic data that we use in the securities cases also tends to show that a very high percentage, maybe somewhere between perhaps a quarter and a third of securitized loans in 05 to 07 didn't comply with the reps and warranties that the banks made about them. And if there are a lot of procedural hurdles in the way of investors doing anything about this, but if they can devise a way over the procedural hurdles, then I think the magnitude of the liability to the of the banks is really huge. And that was the subject of the cartoon. I'm sure you know that, I guess it's 2 weeks ago now, that when B of A had the earnings call and Brian Moynihan was talking about investors in mortgage-backed bonds, and he said these are people who bought a Chevy Vega and now say they bought a Mercedes V12.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them did buy a Mercedes V12. They're called AAA super senior bonds. And if they can find a way of mobilizing in numbers sufficient to get over these procedural hurdles, then I think the liabilities of the banks are quite large.
That's the BlackRock PIMCO group that's trying to put things together, as I understand it.
Well, that's one group. The bigger group is actually the clearinghouse run by Talcott Franklin in Dallas. The PIMCO BlackRock group was kind of a splinter off of the clearinghouse. Some of those guys also belong to the clearinghouse, but Kathy Patrick got, you know, a very good big group of investors to split off. But I think the main effort is Tal Franklin's effort in Dallas.
Which may be taking
you kind of far afield from the origins of the crisis, but since you're...
Sure. No, we're quite interested in it. Let me go back to something you just said. Did you say that one-third of the deals between 05 and 07 did not comply with the reps and warranties?
Well, I said between a quarter and a third of the loans that were securitized did not comply with the reps and warranties. If you look at our CoreLogic data, as I was describing, we run the CoreLogic data over about 225 approximately trusts, many different originators, many different investment banks. I think in no trust are less than 45% of the loans somehow or another implicated by the CoreLogic data, which is a point that I should have made earlier when we were discussing our complaints.
Mm-hmm.
We run the CoreLogic data across all the loans in a pool, and then we eliminate duplicates. So if a loan, let's say a loan has a too low LTV and it has a second lien, we count that loan only once. So if you eliminate duplicates and you look across all the loans, you find that somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 to 50% of the loans in virtually every trust has one or more of these problems identified by the CoreLogic data. And then just for the sake of argument and conservatism, split that in half. Just say, okay, fine, half of these, maybe they're debatable. I'm not sure if they are, but just for the sake of coming up with a conservative estimate, just split it in half. Well, that's 25% of all securitized loans. That's a lot of loans.
Yeah.
Several hundred billion.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Have you guys
looked at Lori Goodman's numbers on this?
Yes, we have.
Okay.
The question, I don't, how much confidence do you put in those?
Well, Lori's estimates of the putback liability, which are in her slides that are on our website in that conference that we gave, in my opinion, are a little low. In general, I think I have the utmost confidence in Lori. I think she's the smartest person in RMBS. But I my own estimates are a little higher than hers. But in general, I have tremendous respect for her.
Well, I know Lou Ranieri has the greatest respect for her, and that goes carries a lot of weight around here.
Well, I think everybody does, really. I've heard one person grumble that since she went to Amherst that her views may be somewhat colored by Amherst's market position. But in general, I've never heard anything but the highest praise for Lori. I think she's rigorous and honest, and she's great. The other, just on the subject of big brains with integrity, the other guy, whom you may not have spoken to, and it may be too late, but the chief credit officer, Standard & Poor's, Mark Adelson. Do you know Mark?
Yeah. We do. You interviewed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Mark taught me structured finance, because when I decided I wanted to learn about this, Mark had his own consulting firm at the time, so my law firm hired Mark to teach us about structured finance, and he's the guy who quit Moody's in protest of their loosening their rating standards, and he is also, like Lori, a big brain and super high integrity.
Yeah, he's at S&P right now, the chief credit officer there.
Right, right. We were really sorry when he took that job because it meant he couldn't work with us anymore.
Yeah.
But those are two people who I think have, you know, tremendous intellectual integrity and big brains.
You spoke of three channels. We've talked about securities claims versus
right. The third channel is litigation against the servicers for the way they're servicing the loans, which is an example of which is the robo-signing. I think that there is widespread misconduct by the servicers, and one of the reasons for it is that, and this is actually something that I'm hoping your report will address, that the conflicts of interest that are built into the structure of securitizations, particularly where the servicer is an affiliate of the seller of the collateral.
All right. So I want to drill down on this issue specifically, conflict of interest, if you don't mind.
Sure. The servicers are subject and indulging themselves in many conflicts of interest. For example, Countrywide is the worst offender, pretty much. But many, many, many Countrywide loans breached the reps and warranties that Countrywide made when they sold them into the securitization trust. We know that from the CoreLogic data. We know that from the state AG's investigation in October of 2008 when they found hundreds of thousands of predatory loans, and there's always a rep that the loan's not predatory. So we know that Countrywide, as an originator, made a lot of loans that didn't comply. One duty of the servicer is to bring to the attention of the trustee loans that don't comply, because then you can get the seller to repurchase them at par and the trust is better off. Countrywide has never pointed out a single loan that doesn't comply with a rep and warranty, because Countrywide as a servicer doesn't want to cause any liability for Countrywide as originator to repurchase those loans. So there's an egregious conflict of interest. I understand that in meetings with investors, Countrywide's head of servicing said, we are never going to report any violation of rep and warranty by Countrywide as originator because it's basically the same company. So there's a conflict. Another conflict is that if you look at the duration of foreclosures, the servicers keep people in their homes longer than they should stay there who can't afford them, because they charge big late fees to the borrowers, and the late fees come out of the trust at the top of the waterfall. So before any investors get paid, the servicer gets its late fees. Another, and this is particularly true of Countrywide, in fact, Lori has an interesting slide in our conference about Countrywide. When the borrower falls behind in making payments, the servicer does what's called force-placed insurance, which is to buy insurance on the property on behalf of the borrower to make sure that it's covered from flood and the like. And Countrywide buys it from an insurance company that it owns called Balboa, and it charges the borrower double market premiums. And then when the borrower doesn't pay, it comes out of the proceeds of the foreclosure, so Countrywide is using the foreclosure to pay double the market of insurance premiums to its captive insurance company, Balboa. So there are many, many, many conflicts of interest of this type that are built into the structure of securitization. And if securitization, in my opinion, is ever going to revive itself, two things that have to change are the elimination of conflicts of interest, and again, I'm hoping your report will recommend this, a thoroughgoing updating of the Trust Indenture Act, because the Trust Indenture Act was designed for the old days of traditional corporate debt issuance, where, you know, General Motors is issuing its 6.75% subordinated debentures for, you know, 25 years, whatever, and it's a traditional indenture with a traditional trustee, and securitization doesn't fit that mold. And until Congress updates the Trust Indenture Act, where the state AGs take an interest in trust indentures under that are secure deals that are sold in their states, securitization investors will never be safe. So, anyway, as far as a channel of litigation is concerned, I am not that optimistic about it, even though I think the servicers are doing plenty wrong, because of the difficulty of proving damages. In the first two channels of litigation, the statutes or the contracts provide for essentially a rescission. So in the Blue Sky cases, if we prove our case, we just get our money back. We don't have to prove how much the bond went down in value or why it went down or anything
sure,
like that.
That's right.
And similarly, in a put-back case, if a loan doesn't comply with the reps and warranties, then the agreement just says that it's bought back at full value. So, again, there's no need to prove damages. The problem with servicer litigation is that you have to prove damages. And it's, you know, we all know proving damages can be difficult. And so I view it as the type of litigation that has the lowest potential return of investment on the litigation dollar. And obviously one thing that clients are always concerned with is, okay, if I'm, you know, spending a dollar with you, am I going to get more than a dollar back from the defendant? And in servicing litigation, I think that calculation is the most difficult.
And the mere
on the
fact,
other hand,
the mere fact of filing is going to adversely affect the market, so it's going to drive down the price anyway.
Well, it'll drive down the price of the stock of the banks. Although I think that putback is a bigger threat to them, but if the attorneys general took an interest in the way servicing is conducted, as they may be under the initiative led by the Iowa AG, that could potentially be a huge threat to the servicers, because they may actually have to reform their servicing practices in response to the AGs when they wouldn't in response to investors. Just let me, I know I'm talking too much, but let me just offer you one more thought about servicing litigation. One of the huge scandals of the financial crisis, in my opinion, that has not gotten very much attention is the way in which the banks are valuing and protecting the second lien mortgages that they have in their own balance sheets. I'm sure you know that in the securitization binge, a lot more first lien loans got securitized than seconds, and the reason is because the seconds had higher interest rates, so they were more profitable for the banks to keep. So not that many second mortgage loans were securitized. And now what we have is a situation where the big four banks have about $440 billion of second lien mortgages or HELOCs on their own books, and they're also servicing the majority of first lien loans on the same properties that were securitized. If what those banks are doing, and this is the biggest conflict of interest of all, is that they are encouraging borrowers to stay current on the seconds while becoming delinquent and therefore and thereafter modifying the firsts, which reverses the normal priority of liens and understandably makes first lien investors quite angry. But the other thing that it does, and this I consider to be not yet sufficiently addressed by the government, is that the banks have made very small provisions against possible credit losses on their second liens. And if they were to lose their servicing rights, then a new servicer would come in and would not be willing to modify the firsts in order to protect the seconds, and then the banks would presumably be under pressure from their auditors to make realistic provisions against losses on the seconds. And that is the greatest conflict of interest at all, and it's one that the SEC has been uninterested in, as far as I know. I know the SEC is just getting interested in the putback issue because they sent a letter to the CFOs of a bunch of banks yesterday. But this whole issue about the banks using servicing to protect their second lien loans on their own portfolios is a huge scandal. The amount of the second lien loans is equal to the bank's equity, and most observers think that they're worth 10 or 20 cents on the dollar, because if the true lien priority were enforced. So that's, I think, the reason why the servicers would fight litigation very hard if there was any threat of removing them as servicers, because they need to stay in place as servicers to protect their second liens.
David, do you have where's your source for the $440 billion?
Laurie Goodman's slides annotated to the financial statements. If you go on our website, her slides are available in a PDF, and I believe she annotates it to the bank's financial statements.
Good. That's the three channels, then.
That's just kind of how I see mortgage litigation developing right now.
Yeah.
I
mean, David, it may very well be, after we've had an opportunity to digest what you've told us and after we've had an opportunity to review some materials, that we would like to be back in touch with you, and we would hope that you would help us out, if you don't mind.
No, I'd be happy to. I get to Washington fairly often, so if you want me to stop by, I'd be happy to. I'm going to be I need to leave for court here shortly, and then tomorrow I'm going to be in San Francisco. Right. Thursday and Friday I'll be back in my office, and then later next week I'd be happy to swing by and meet you guys in your office, or if you want to talk again on the phone, that's fine.
That'd be great.
That'd be terrific. David, could you speak to just a second for why do you think it's taken this long for suits to start being filed? I mean, you talked about how the statute of limitations is running out. Why do you think it took this long?
Well, I'm going to answer that question partly on the record and partly off the record. On the record, I would say that the factor that we hear the most often is fear of retribution from the banks. And I hear that when I speak to investors every week, that if their name becomes known, that the banks will cut them off from credit lines or whatever else that they do with the banks, and since there are only four big banks, they have a lot of power. Other reasons that I've heard and that I'm willing to discuss on the record are, in the earlier years, in 2008, there was some optimism that the bonds would recover their value. I think there was some embarrassment that people had bought the bonds. In large institutions, I think oftentimes they had sold bonds in one part of the institution and bought in a different one, and they wanted to figure out what their net liability was. But those are the factors that I've seen, and there are a couple others that I'd be willing to discuss privately.
David, one other thing. The investors in these bonds, was it particularly with respect to the following the date of the filing of the supplemental prospectus, how much time were they given to review the documents? And the documents, to the extent that they could be reviewed, were they sufficiently transparent so as to make an informed investment decision?
Well, taking your second question first, I think the answer to that is yes, they were transparent, because they basically follow the form that was prescribed by SEC Regulation AB, and the statistics about the mortgage loans are presented in numerous tables that are standardized, and everybody knows how to read them, and everybody knows what data will be conveyed in them, and so I don't think there was any problem.
Assumes, however, that the Reg AB stuff is sufficient in and of itself.
It does. does. It does assume that. But at least as far as transparency goes, if by transparency you mean accessibility and you could get to the information that you knew you were going to find in there, I don't think there was any issue of that, because basically they were presented in statistical tables, and bond people know how to read these tables. And when we talk to investors, I don't think we've encountered any people complaining that those tables were not presented clearly or anything like that. As far as time to review the information is concerned, the normal sequence was that the investment bank would send, in advance of the settlement of the trade, drafts of the statistical tables. And depending on the institution and depending on the buyer, they would review that. And in some cases, they would actually negotiate it. In the smaller buyers, it was pretty much take it or leave it. But the big buyers, such as the FHLBs, were actually able sometimes to negotiate some improvement. For example, the San Francisco Bank consistently negotiated more credit enhancement than was initially proposed to them. They had credit standards that, however much credit enhancement the rating agencies required for AAA, the San Francisco Bank would require twice or three times or sometimes four times more than that. So they would sometimes negotiate that, and then they would get revised statistical tables. As far as the prospectus supplement itself, with all of the words in addition to the tables, that would usually come after the buyer had agreed to buy the bond, but before the settlement of the trade. And then most buyers have a department that checks to make sure that the numbers in the final prospectus supplement correspond with the numbers that had been coming in the drafts of the statistical tables, and that the prospectus supplement was otherwise satisfactory. And if so, then they would settle the trade. But they had actually made the decision to buy the bonds subject to that, based on the statistical tables, and then before actually settling the trade would have a chance to review the prospectus supplement itself.
But fundamentally, your complaint is founded in that the information that was in the prospectus was not true.
Correct.
Okay. So although it was transparent, it was wrong.
Yes, I mean, if by transparent, as I say, you mean it was easily accessed. Yes, it was easily accessed. In our opinion, it was inaccurate, materially inaccurate. But so it was not giving transparency into the true quality of the mortgage loans. But the document was, you know, easy enough to read.
David, at this juncture, we're going to go off the record, and it's what time, John?
It's 5 minutes to 12.
5 minutes to 12, we are off the record.